session number 30304.
Tedrina, reel 29.
There were plenty of good luck wishes as we four crews prepared to leave, mostly, I think, from the strong conviction that something should be done to try to prevent any repetition of those dreadful losses of 814,000 tons of Allied shipping in November 1942. The squadron had endured hundreds of hours of patrolling, escorting, searching in bleak winter weather, and knowing where nearly all the action was, but unable to reach it. 269 had managed two attacks on U-boats, probably on passage to join other U-boats further west. That was on the 16th of January, 1943. So following a poor opening to the year and knowing well what was needed, we were not to know then that the year 1943 would bring ultimate triumph over the U-boats. A visit to Greenland in the middle of the Northern Hemisphere winter did not have quite the same appeal as a visit in summer would offer, but nevertheless we were enthusiastic tourists. Two facts were paramount as we took off at 10:44 hours. One, we needed to land at the Greenland base of Bluey West 1 in daylight, as the approach up the fjord to the airfield was anything but a straight line. And two, note well the point of no return. Go beyond it, as Pug, a navigator, put it, fingers crossed, and everything was, to steal a phrase, shipshape. Go back at this last opportunity to do so was a phrase of two redundant words. So, Greenland, here we come. And the flight was quite commonplace for that time and that latitude. And Greenland gave us a chilly, foggy welcome. At about 1,000 feet, 10 miles from the coast, I remember we met the ice we'd been expecting. A patch, I think it was, of coagulated scotia here and there, with a thin overhanging mist indicating the cold East Greenland current beneath. Then runs of firmer ice and thicker mist until we reached continuous ice and the mist became a dull, threatening fog, which almost eclipsed what meager daylight the day had managed to produce. We could have expected Fingal's Cave to appear next. Suddenly, the coastal cliffs appeared, truncated into columns of rocky pillars, a most amazing effect by the leveling effect of reduced upward visibility. It was as though we had a stage and a proscenium arch and a limit to how far up we could look, and they just looked like columns. We made a sharp turn to port, continuing at a height of 100 feet parallel to the coastline. Well, as I might have guessed, Pug's navigation had brought us to the intended landfall, and after 10 minutes of flying through the tunnel of gloom, the fog thinned and gradually disappeared. The cliff face veered away to the west, and we knew that just round the corner we would see the imposing mass of Cap Farvel. In pantomime terms, it was reminiscent of a theatrical scene change from the villain's dark cave to the prince's lake by the palace. The sky was now clear, and the ice reaching down behind the ledges of rock had a pale blue aura which deepened to aquamarine in the crevices. Sheet ice, which covered the water for some distance from the shore, had been sprinkled with a thin layer of gleaming snow. There was no problem in recognizing the island turning point. It was the only one with a radio mast on it. We turned to fly up the ominous-looking fjord and saw before us a channel which in its grandeur and precision looked like some gigantic scheme of human engineering, like a cavern with steep sides infiltrated with fingers of ice, a pale blue ceiling canopied over the still waters beneath. And the sun was slowly disappearing behind us as the corridor ahead narrowed, casting long shadows from projecting rocks on the cliff faces. And they ranged up to 3,000 feet within a short distance of each side, making any future need for a turnaround in the field seem a bit tricky. The ice cap, as yet invisible, signaled its presence by the heavy pale grey sky beyond the far horizon. We faced a wall of rock as we approached the head of the fjord. Where would we go next? But shortly we could see we needed a turn to port, and another wall of rock came into view. And then, to starboard, there was the airfield, on the only area of reasonably level ground we had seen since leaving Iceland. Even then, on a tight circuit, it was obvious that the long runway sloped from the end nearest the ice cap down to the waters of the fjord. So it would be necessary to land up it. A new approach to landing, as you might say. Well, this we did. I think it was about 17:15 hours local time. Surprised at the much shortened landing run the upward gradient caused, and with what looked like a mile of runway unused ahead. Probably the only landing ground which could be described as a direct link twixt deep lagoon and truncated glacier, it owed its existence to a freak of nature many years ago, when the ice which had gouged its way down to the sea for some reason then stopped short. Perhaps an earlier global warning, leaving a level area strewn with debris which in one or two corners could still be seen collected into mounds of rock.
How long did the flight take, Ted?
What time did we say we took off? It was about six and a half, 17 hours we landed, and we took off 6.5 hours.
Is there a time difference between Iceland and Greenland?
As soon as we came within the orbit, shall we say, of Greenland, we went on to their local time. And I can't remember, quite frankly, whether there's an actual difference in the two. But it was commonplace if you were operating from an area with a different time scale to immediately change to that. And that's indicated on the times given, which I might mention in another situation, that you simply add the letter Z after the time. So if in this case we're saying we landed at 17:15 hours, Z would indicate that is the time in Greenland at the time. And our Hudsons, joined a cluster of United States Air Force machines, including Marauders, Mitchells, Bostons, and Dakotas. Lights began to appear beyond the landing and parking areas, revealing the wide extent of the base. Vehicles of many shapes and sizes passed to and fro, and giant, great big snow-clearing machines were being moved into position, presumably in case they were needed next morning. And we didn't even know this place existed. Our briefing at Calderdanus had not led us to expect anything as big and bustling as this, and already questions were forming in our minds why this base offered nothing so far to our war against U-boats.
What was the purpose of the American presence there?
Well, the whole purpose, as I shall have to unfortunately mention as we go on, because of the congestion, I'm trying to think to back to just how many aircraft seemed to be there in this place unknown to us. All we had in Iceland to go by was a very simple hashed map, no contours on it, but we knew that the ice cap reached about 11,000 feet, but we didn't know how far it extended. And the whole purpose, it seemed, Bluey West 1, as were the whole of Greenland actually, was garrisoned, if you like, by the U.S. Army, and certainly, the orders had gone out on high that we must prepare for an invasion of Europe and we'd need a lot of aircraft for it. And this Bluey West 1 was one of the staging posts for the smaller bombers, the twin-engine particularly bombers. In fact, larger aircraft couldn't have done the necessary manoeuvres to get up the fjord and turn as necessary and get on a path up to the runway. And so this is what really we found quite annoying in a way, that there were aircraft there and we felt that they could have been used even by people who were not accustomed to flying anti-U-boat patrols and so on. These aircraft were largely flown, well, by ferry command eventually of the RAF in conjunction with many civil American pilots, certainly until America's war effort increased. And they flew on the beam. And that's why there are lots of American aircraft still, I suppose, now covered by sheets of ice on the ice cap, because they flew at a height of about 10,000 feet on the beam. And on the approach, I think I mentioned the fact that one of the islands at the base of the field up which we had to flow had an aerial on it. That was the beam that they had to come in on. And then they wouldn't fly. Many of the pilots openly said, well, I couldn't fly on dead reckoning. I need a beam. And the next beam was at Reykjavik. So unless the weather was fit to fly at a height best for receiving the beam, they didn't go. And at this time during the winter, aircraft could perhaps get from one beam place to the next, but not to go onwards as you would expect in better weather. So, as I said, it was an absolute eye-opener because we'd no idea that this is what happened. At this time, you see, we as a squadron 269 were still based at Calderdanus, We didn't know everything that was going on at Reykjavik. If we'd seen on certain days lots of aircraft coming into Reykjavik or taking off to go to the next stage, which was to Prestwick in Scotland, we would have been at least a little more in the know. But being at Caldidanus and doing it, our own job from there, we were quite ignorant of it.
So how were you received when you arrived?
Sorry?
How were you received when you arrived?
Well, on the first evening, it went dark after we landed. I mean, you're landing at that time. Was what, probably an hour before it was too dark to see very much. And as I mentioned, lights were coming on here and there, so we were simply we were picked up in a Jeep, or was it a Dodge? Anyway, typical American Army vehicle. And just taken to the mess and the dormitory where we would be spending quite a few nights. But shortly after that, we were given quite a bit of help so far as they were able to. The problem was that I imagine that Headquarters Iceland, or Coastal Command Headquarters for that matter, imagined that it would be possible for the Americans to give us more help than they actually could or did, because they obviously had great problems of their own. They had the equipment to deal with the problems, such as warm air machines to de-ice the wings of the aircraft, but only on very rare occasions were we able to get that kind of help. But certainly amongst the rank and file, we were all buddies very, very quickly. Well, of course, now you've nudged a memory. We have to think of, let's see what was, oh yes, Major Lindsay of the US Army Air Force was the control officer. We reported to him, and we found we were all to be billeted together, mess buildings for officers and NCOs are not yet completed. But memories and food are often linked. So I can positively say that the word rations meant something different in the American use of the word. And it was obvious the inner man was going to be well supplied throughout our stay. Breakfast, gammon, bacon, sausages, eggs, tomatoes, and then some. Ah, forgot the grapefruit. We seemed a long way from frontline action, but it was waiting just round the corner. It was suggested next day we should visit the Admiral, very much, I fear, a rear Admiral, in charge of the naval section. We were uncertain as to what this included. There was no obvious sign of naval activity. The Admiral gave every indication of being uncertain himself. But he might have thought himself unlucky to find his war effort relegated to being of little importance against what was emerging as the primary task of BW1, this ferrying of USAAF aeroplanes to Britain. Tactics about U-boats against U-boats. He was concerned that two troop-carrying ships bringing American servicemen to Greenland had recently been sunk, with many men lost from what was obviously a great ordeal in the icy water. And we visited some of the survivors later in the base hospital and the plight they were suffering severe frostbite. It was pitiful to see. They said they had no air cover. If the Admiral was hoping to avoid a similar catastrophe, we would certainly do all we could to help. But efforts to pass on suggestions gleaned from hard-won experience were not eagerly accepted, and we discerned a lack of real interest in helping to protect the convoys now being forced ever nearer Greenland's frozen shores. Well, Jimmy, as our senior officer and detachment commander, obviously, Jimmy Haig, that is, obviously knew the state of play better than we did. We were still under the control, believe it or not, of headquarters Iceland, which seemed less than sensible when they knew so little about local circumstances. It wasn't long before we realized that equally seriously there was a lack of local information about convoys, their routes, and their tactics.
Therefore, was it supposed that when you flew to Greenland that you would organise your own operational flying?
We were unsure as to what we were going to do, apart from, as best we could, carry out air cover of some form, escort, patrol, whatever. And we would be, to a certain extent, dependent on what we found there. We were already, we had enough experience, and all of us were second tour people, to organize a cooperative effort to provide what we would provide from any other RAF station. But it was a matter of, it was a problem to actually know who was in charge, to whom we should go for help. There was I've read quite a bit of differences of opinion between the U.S. Army and the U.S. Navy, and my goodness, it was pretty obvious that at Bluey West, there was only one thing in the Army mind, getting their aircraft across to UK. So there were occasions, as perhaps I may remember as we go along, when we ourselves organized, knowing that there was a convoy within reach, we would organize our own cover for it.
Because also at this time, with you being RAF Coastal Command, you kind of fall in between the US Army Air Force and the US Navy's divisions of labor, don't you?
Yes.
Being maritime.
Yes. Yes, which is something that they didn't really understand. They didn't understand our, shall we say, formal situation in terms of what the service stood for and was trying to achieve, and we couldn't quite see why they couldn't combine better. It's very difficult to put it into words because it was an atmosphere as much as anything. We did in the mess get a great welcome. We were overwhelmed actually by the camaraderie and hospitality. The alcoholic beverages were not entirely to our taste, but this became less noticeable as the evening wore on. Any Army Air Force officer would be plying us with drinks. What I wanted to say was that an Army Air Force lieutenant, jumped on a bar stool and called the keybird. And there was an echoing roar, the keybird, from the congregation. He took from his pocket a creased piece of paper and started to recite the following verses. Fortunately, he gave me a copy, so here goes. The song of the keybird. You have heard the wail of the siren as an ambulance sped down the street, and mayhap you've heard the lion's deep roar down in Africa's grim and desert heat, or the piercing cry of the tiger at night as he stalks his prey, or the locomotive's high shrill whistle as it sped through the night on its way. But these sounds are no more than a whisper. You've heard naught, I assure, till I've told of the blood-curdling cry of the keybird in the Arctic's cruel, frigid cold. This bird looks just like a buzzard. It's large, it's hideous, it's bold. In the night as it circles o'er Greenland, crying, "Eek, eek, 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 oh!" The Eskimos tucked in their igloo toss fretfully while in their sleep, and their huskies asleep in a snowbank start burrowing way down deep. For this cry is so awe-inspiring, it freezes the blood, I am told, as the keybird flies in the Arctic crying, "Kink, kink, kink, oh!" The mounted abroad on their dog sleds visiting these wards of the crown oft hear this cry and stare skyward with a fierce and desperate frown. For odd things happen in the Arctic and many weird tales they have told, but their voices drop to a whisper hearing, "Ki-ki-ki-ki-ki-ho!" And many a brave man on base site, strong and bold but now in a state, will be taking the first ship back homewards to forget this bird's song of hate. They can take it seems, in the daytime, but when midnight's hour is told, they cover their heads in protection against so back in the States they are going to sleep in a real bed as of old, to slip strong arms round a loved one, her fair slender form to enfold, then off to sleep in warm comfort, and wife's soft hand they will hold, to wake, terrorized by a keen nightmare, and the cry, "Kicking the right bed home!" In the daytime, the hive of activity that was the camp, and not only on the airfield, but amongst the many wooden buildings, some going up, some being worked on inside, and others would be being wired or painted, and the daddy of them all, the new officer's mess, being fitted with a stone-walled chimney. A stone-walled chimney seemed rather incongruous in a land with no wood or coal. excuse me, it was at BW1 that I experienced for the first time a communal convenience. I entered, and it was immediately obvious that about half the 30-odd seats were occupied. Obvious because there was a complete lack of privacy. Seating was arranged on the four sides of a square, each side being a continuous length of wooden planks with a number of holes about the size of a normal toilet seat in the surface. The open space in the middle of the box left no one in any doubt about its contents. There was no artificial heating in the room, although there was considerable warmth generated from natural sources. Indeed, from the number of occupants blissfully sitting there, reading newspapers and magazines during working hours, one could only assume that it was much preferred to the task in the frigid air outside, which had to be temporarily abandoned in order to let nature take its course. During the brief period, we were obliged to use the latrines before opening the new officer's mess. There were one or two tricks we learned from the experienced incumbents. Firstly, to keep a close watch on the toilet paper which had to be taken to the chosen seat, because it was more than likely that the fellow on the next seat would have forgotten his. Secondly, that should digestive problems tend to produce audible evidence of the natural act, sit next to someone and look at him in surprise when the audible act occurred, and try to avoid patronage during the busy time just after breakfast, because you may find that all the occupants are sadistic people who enjoy watching you pacing up and down waiting for a vacancy.